Hello. You've tuned in to Waste Division Book Club. We're calling it Waste Books for now. A podcast where we get together and talk about books of our choosing. We will announce a couple weeks in advance of our podcast release every month what book we read so that you have an opportunity to read it if you are so inclined. However, we have tried to structure our conversation here such that you can follow along and hopefully find it interesting without having read the book. If you just want to hear people talk about books and ideas, that hopefully will work perfectly fine. And then if you maybe are inspired to read the book after hearing us talk about it, you can always do that. But anyway, let's get into it here and start off with some introductions. Hope you enjoy. Thanks.
My name is Cooper Malin, a Montana native with a two-year associate's degree from a community college in Oregon.
And this is Phil, wasting away in Billings, Montana. I got a degree in English and philosophy, and this is one of the few avenues that I can use that. Also do some music in a band called Bull Market and with a couple other dudes in different projects.
This is Jordan Finn, living in Brooklyn, New York. Raised in Montana and California, but living here now, and writing and working and teaching and playing in a band in Idaho Green.
So, Eric Tonis, out in Eugene, Oregon, originally from Billings, Montana, the Magic City. I got a degree in creative writing from Montana. And I'm just chilling out here writing. Yeah.
Not great. With us this time, Dan Nichols, who is currently in Thailand teaching English or learning how to teach English.
Is he learning English? Nailed it. Nailed it.
He's a little bit. English. A little bit of both.
He couldn't make it because he's probably hungover. It's like 11:30.
Yeah, it's pretty late over there for him.
A.M.
Classic.
This is a this is a monthly podcast where we will have chosen a book, separately read it, and we are coming together now and going to discuss it. This month we have David Gates Jernigan, his first novel he published in 1991. Is there anybody who wants to discuss the book, or I guess just talk about the hell the book's about?
I'll volunteer, yeah. Okay. Here we go. So, yeah, Jernigan. It's essentially about this character in his late 30s named Jernigan. Actually, can't remember what his first name is. It's
Peter.
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 Peter Jernigan, who lives in Jersey. He is sort of representative of a lot of like suburban malaise, and I don't know, he's kind of sort of postmodern character. Throughout the novel, it pretty much starts at the end with him in a trailer in the woods of New Hampshire, and it paints this very, very lurid picture, probably my favorite part of the entire novel. Very dark, and thankfully it steers but it steers away from that, and it goes back to that summer beforehand, 80s, I think it mentions Reagan, so it's 88, 87 maybe, after that recession. And basically, over the course of that 6 months, on the 4th of July, he has a son, he's very disconnected with his son. He also, in many ways, is
Donnie.
It's Danny.
His what? Donnie. His son Donnie.
Isn't it Danny?
And
it's Danny.
I think it's Danny.
Yeah, it's Danny.
Okay.
Like and Dan.
like our lovely Dan. And yeah, in the basically, he's very disconnected with his son. His wife, you come to find out, died the year before that on the 4th of July in a freak accident involving alcohol, which alcohol is a huge theme in this novel. It was a novel about alcoholism without actually being a novel about alcoholism. It's not what it's about, but it's certainly like it motivates the vast majority of the action in this. And so he meets this woman who is the mother of his son's mother at a party. They get together and become romantically entangled, but Jernigan is also pretty not very sentimental. And you can kind of tell that there's no way it can end romantically. And all their relationships pretty much disintegrate over the course of the 6 months. And you find out the postmodern shenanigans that he's come to find out that he's in a treatment center. If that was all that you
did. Part of rehab.
And that this document reading is part of his
steps. Him walking the steps, I guess.
Yeah, it's very Catcher in the Rye esque.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, thanks, Jordan. Does anybody have any burning topic they wanted to start out on? Like the biggest one that jumped out at them?
One of my favorite scenes was him with his dad. And just like the whole character of his father as like the salty old artiste.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which if we're led to believe that he was a very, people liked his art, you know, people bought his art, and he was a pretty respected artist.
Yeah, he had like some kind of substantial income at the time for some of his paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder what the relationship between him and his father in that respect kind of played on his relationship with Danny.
Right. Well, and that's what a lot that goes to a larger point. What this book is about is lineage, I think, and how that affects the choices we can or can't or don't make.
For all intents and purposes, Jernigan's like a very intelligent man. He's a very brilliant man. Who seems to have no qualms in not using his intelligence. This book isn't about him like lamenting the choices he did or did not make. It seems that he's actively chosen this sort of dismal suburban lifestyle.
Phil and Jordan, do you guys see a little bit of Gates himself in this character?
Oh yeah.
I just like think about him in class, like talking about stories every time I hear like Jernigan.
Well, that's probably something we should mention, Eric. So
yeah, did all three of you guys have him as a professor at the University of Montana?
I did not.
I've never seen
David Gates.
Were we in the same class, Phil?
We were in
fiction one.
No, I don't think we ever were.
Oh, I had him for a fiction workshop in like my senior year.
Uh huh.
And it was really awesome. He's very like unique, derelict as hell.
Yeah, he used to talk to us about how much pot he smoked and like mentioned that one time he was up at his own cabin, actually upstate, in upstate New York there. And somebody found him at his computer with like tears in his eyes. It was apparent that he'd been in this position for some time. He was playing solitaire. He had like a mental breakdown and solitaire was the only thing that, he's definitely got, and he's burned through a couple relationships and stuff.
He always wore the same attire. He had this long ponytail, old ratty baseball cap, circular glasses from like the fucking 40s or 50s, a Bennington mm-hmm. College sweatshirt, jeans, and like boots.
Mm-hmm. One time he wore sunglasses in class.
The whole time?
The rock star?
Exactly. Now, do you think that this book is about a man's mental breakdown because of his wife's death?
Sort of. It has, I think, a lot to do with it.
Because I think the one scene that we get between Jernigan and his wife, and I forget her name, if she even is given a name.
What's her name?
The one scene we get, I mean, actually, there's two scenes.
Judith,
yeah.
The scene where Danny is born, I read that there was a lot of love in that passage.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed like he loved her and she loved him, and his use of little joke, that thing he would say after an ironic twist or some little thing he said, that was a thing he borrowed from her, which led me to believe that he still thinks about her, even if he doesn't admit it in the novel itself, which of course is his journaling. So he's going to be sharing what he wants or doesn't want.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Is this a mental breakdown? Is this just this, you know, the book describes it as a man going over the edge with his eyes open the entire time. And does it explain why him and his son Danny have such a strained relationship? What, you know, we don't get to see what it was like before this, before her accident.
Right.
We just get to see the results of it. And
well, the impression is that, like, he, from what I remember, there was another period where he was drinking a quart of liquor a day. It was actually, I think it was around when Danny was born, he mentioned it. So he's obviously had problems. He basically drove his wife to go crazy, strip naked at a dinner party, and then
bizarre.
Run out and get hit by a car. So he's had a long trend of being an asshole, I think.
Do you think?
But of course, the tragedy of this is that he is so smart and potentially very sensitive, and all he can do is numb out.
Right.
But in that vein, there was one review of this book. I was trying to find it. It was just one of the blurbs. It says a deeply moral book. And I was wondering what you guys made of that, because that struck me as sort of funny given how nihilistic and amoral he seems to be.
Maybe it's something to do with, like, I feel like a lot of times when he is having an interior monologue, he like says one thing in his head and then will actively do or say the opposite thing out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like his character identifies both sides of these moralistic issues and maybe knows which one is wrong, but he's actively taking the immoral choice out of some spite.
What's he spiteful about, do you think?
I don't know.
He's got it made. He's a white male, comes from a decent background.
Right, and that's what I've been wondering. Does it have to do with his father being like kind of a semi-famous artist who is creative and kind of revered in a sense, and he's kind of, I don't know.
I'm trying to unpack. I need to interrupt. I think maybe this is a dumb question, but like, what is a moral book? Can somebody give me an example of what an incredibly moral book would be? Because Phil, it seems like you don't agree that this is a moral book, or at least shocked by somebody saying that.
I just thought it was funny given the nature of the character.
So what's a moral book?
J-Bone?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say that it's funny that, I think this is a good name dropping, but people talk about Thomas Pynchon as a very moral writer, but when you read a lot of his work, it seems very immoral, or at least amoral. And I think that there is some sort of a vision or some sort of an idea of preferred action or some sort of an idea of negative behavior or some sort of a brutal behavior. There isn't a kind of morality in this. It's his integrity and his inability to be dishonest. Moral, and I think that even at the very end, he still holds vision of, you know, I'll swallow the pill that you're giving me, but I still call bullshit, and I'll just do the bare minimum for me to like still be a functioning entity in the system. I don't believe in any of this, and he's here because he has to be there. He doesn't have a choice.
Right.
That reminds me of the scene where he gets fired. He gets let go from his job, and he says, like, fuck you very much to his boss, but he only does it because he says to himself, I feel like I should say this. And he doesn't mean it. I don't think he truly means you know, fuck you very much. I mean, he points out, like, this is, I feel like this is an appropriate situation where I should say this. So I'm just going to go ahead and say it.
What did the, I think there's a part right after he says that where then he says in his head, the boss asks what, and he said, yeah, got him, or something like that. And I wasn't sure what that meant.
Oh.
I don't know if you remember that. That's kind of oddly specific.
Maybe he'd lost his sense of logic or reason.
It was like he had like successfully tricked the boss or something by saying that.
Is it right after he says fuck you very much?
Yes, like right after.
I think it's because the boss says for what? And so like the boss didn't even hear him. The boss just heard him say thank you very much.
Oh, okay. That makes a little more sense.
So I think that just shows how far
out. Right. It was just so subtle.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and there's lots of subtle things, and that's something that he always liked in class, was just like
little things. And like he talked about how there's no real way to be original, like in terms of big picture stuff.
Like at this point, the big stuff's been done in fiction. And so I think he sees the chances for originality coming out in just like little moments like that, or I don't have one ready, but I just, there's a, like a very subtle taste there. It struck me that part of why this might be considered a moral book is what it says about, and you kind of touched on this, Jordan, capitalism.
I'm going to go there.
And I love just, capitalism. Because, like, he has a job. He has an office job that affords him a severance package. He's apparently good enough at it to be there for
15 years.
Yeah, a decent amount of time.
I thought his boss ended up telling him he didn't like him. But...
which is like understandable. As the reader, I was like, yeah, no, I get you, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't like Jernigan in real life either.
Right. No, but on the other hand, he's really funny and really creative. And I think you kind of get a picture of a guy who's really, really sensitive, actually.
I just see he's like tragically, his talents are wasted on just sort of bullshit. But he seems fine. Like, he doesn't seem like he tried to not waste whatever talents he may or may not have. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like, does anybody else get the feeling that...
Well, he didn't drink his ass off.
Yeah.
So is he tragic that way? I mean, I would see him as being tragic if he went for something and then failed. But
right.
He's sad more than anything, but not in, like, the old Homerian tragic sense. He's just a sad person who just hasn't ever done anything.
It seems like, yeah, because he's moderately successful in his career, but it's just that... not a lot of people necessarily like him, even though his successful status as a male, as far as like a career.
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned to Phil numerous times, like there were times where he'd be having a conversation with somebody that it made me uncomfortable to read because he was making choices in what he was saying that like, I, as a self-proclaimed asshole, could never even like imagine saying out loud to somebody.
Right, totally.
You know what I mean?
And he'd say the right thing to say like beforehand sometimes in his head.
Does anybody have an example they could pull out?
I'll take a look.
Well, just talking with Martha, you know, Martha in this novel was like a caring mother who was trying her best, who despite... I mean, it read like the end of a relationship, which is really nice on Gates's part for like kind of capturing that really heartbreaking and heartrending dialogue between two people who are obviously falling out of love. But some of the things he would say to her just, you know, it broke my heart for this fictional Martha.
Mm-hmm.
Again, because like Eric pointed out, oftentimes he would in his head say, I know I should probably say this or not say it. And I mean, really, he's just trying to get a reaction out of people is how I read it.
Right.
I honestly think his one true, and there's probably many, but the one that stands out in my mind of like a true reaction, and he'd been drinking, of course, was when he went over to Tom's house and he had, you know, this whole book been led to believe that
him and or Tom and Martha had been cheating. And so his aggression there and his standoffishness was understandable to the reader, where at other times, at least for me, I couldn't get why he felt the need to be this way with the world.
Yeah, and I think Martha mentioned that a few times to him directly about him being kind of a pessimist and kind of almost sabotaging himself with his, you know, attitude.
Kind of.
That's a good way of saying it. Yeah, I would say that he's a saboteur of his own life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some, like, we're making it sound like nothing happens except for this man just goes through life and then falls off a cliff or whatever the back of the book says. But there are some, like, really big things that happen that, because of the way Jernigan writes it, we as the reader push it off as well.
Ah.
You know, the death of his wife sounds terrifying and obviously is having a lasting impact on him and his son. Mm-hmm. But we as the reader are led to believe that we can just push this aside.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with when Danny's friend shoots himself in the head with a .22 pistol in his living room, and he finds his dead body after having a conversation with him while he was alive. That's a huge thing that otherwise would be forgotten by the end of the novel, because he doesn't bring it up. He doesn't say,
right,
all of these things have led to me being drunk in this cabin with an infected hand, like self-inflicted bullet wound in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
So as the readers, we're like, we're breezed past these things. Again, when he shoots himself in the hand, it happens so fast that you could almost not have caught it.
Right.
Yeah, he plays it off really well.
Yeah.
Like almost like weirdly well. Like he gets off on feeling that pain.
Right, exactly. Mm. And it's not too subtle, but I mean, he doesn't out and out say that they had to amputate part of his hand. I mean, maybe they do, but the reader knows that he had a crazy infection that they had to amputate part of his hand. But it is done in the Jernigan way, where you, again, as a reader, are like, oh yeah, nah, that just happened. That's a thing now for him.
That's a thing now for him. That, yep, that's a thing.
Right, because he even says in the rehab center, the treatment center, like, you know, things are a little bit harder now with only one thumb. And again, I don't believe that I would react that way if I had lost my thumb and first finger or whatever it was to a self-inflicted gunshot wound that got infected.
I'd be pretty fucking pissed at myself.
Or something. I mean, even the fact that the book led to that decision by him, the book led to him shooting himself in the hand to just feel something.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I think maybe a big thing about, they talk about the zeitgeist of like the 80s and like late capitalism and
like Star Trek, you know, he stays up to watch Star Trek all the time.
Yeah, that, like, well, that as well. Yeah. But I feel in this society, this kind of like Fight Club society, Fight Club makes references to this too, how people don't really have a manifestation of their internal suffering. Like they had in other generations, and it's a post-war thing, but they have this sense that they should be so happy, and I think he really, really despises that external manifestations of happiness and in the media and in the world around him, and he's very resentful for it. And I think that he sees all this internal anguish come out in these acts of violence, and violence is a huge theme throughout. It's not just like something that gets brought up, like Chekhov's gun.
Right.
It's something that is a reoccurring force that he can always return to, especially as the white paternal figure. That's sort of his way out. At the end of the day, he's got the gun.
Right.
He's got the fist. And I don't know. That's how he can manifest his frustration in really ugly ways.
But what's interesting,
Sorry. Oh, I was just to finish, as far as the zeitgeist thing, I felt that's why he did those things, like shoot his hand and basically hold his family hostage. And I think he just needs to see these things in some sort of form. Otherwise, he's just another smiling fucker on his front lawn watering his plants.
But I think what's interesting, we've brought up capitalism a couple of times in this book, or at least Jernigan himself is I don't know, I guess, well, it's not like he was getting at was anti-capitalist, but he's also anti-alternative. I mean, the rest of the book is, you know, Martha and her community are a bunch of suburban survivalists, as they call themselves, who would, for all intents and purposes, be a group of people that, if you're anti-capitalist, you'd be in favor of what they're trying to do. But he could really give a fuck. I mean, he openly mocks it, and
yeah, he really fucking hates them.
He's a true, to him, they're the most obnoxious people. And so it's not like he. It's not.
But
like
it's this, all. He also describes it as his kind of scene.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just if Jernigan's saying that, that's just an offhand way of just saying fuck them. Like, this is fun for a bit.
I think he just really despises satisfaction in any form.
Like he will never be able to find happiness.
Yeah, I think he realizes that no one will, and as soon as you tell yourself you will, then you've already begun lying to yourself, and he's unwilling to do that, and that's what's so enduring about his character.
Mm. Oh, what about like
maybe moral?
What was that, Jordan?
Maybe moral. Well, as far as being a moral novel, that's his ability to constantly laugh at other people's attempts to say that they're happy. It's very, very Beckett reading this. Mm.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah.
Anyway, what were we going to say, Eric?
Oh, I was going to say that maybe he also has some kind of contempt for their faux representation of survivalist. And you know, that's why, like, the whole maybe idea of Fred, Uncle Fred's, like, cabin or whatever, you know, house out more in the woods and away from society is him trying to escape from that, like, faux representation of, like, she's like, you know, have a self-sustaining garden and, like, you know, meat source in her house, but she's still in the suburbs, so it's not. So what does that really represent? Is she really being a survivalist? You know.
Yeah, that's like two sides of the two antipodes of like what survivalism means, and one's like in a suburbia, New Jersey, and the other is literally in like the backwoods of New Hampshire by himself.
Right, and I think he kind of just grew some kind of a hate toward the whole idea that, you know, what they thought they were doing was more important than it was to him.
Mm. But that's true for anything. I mean, anybody could have come across Jernigan's path and he would have felt the same contempt for them.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
He's not going to come into some sort of commune-like situation where he's finally found his people. Okay? He tried that with his first wife, and we got to, you know, they seem to be fine, but they were both probably such toxic characters that it led to her. You know,
they were drinking. That's the other, like, oh, yeah. Everybody's always drinking in this. Especially Jernigan, but
I think he mentioned he even cheated on his first wife, like casually, subtly at one point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, his escape, quote unquote, to the woods. I mean, it couldn't be farther from like Thoreau or Emerson. I mean, all he's doing is drinking gin.
Yeah. Right.
That's it. He's not like some sort of model to look up to. It's like, get away from the suburban sprawl and go to the woods. There's nothing else for him to do.
Wasn't he drinking on the road also up there?
He pissed himself, held his family hostage, shot in the room where his family was at, and then dipped. Like, again, he's not like an example to look up to, so I don't think we can take from it. Like, this is.
No, I think he's pretty cool.
I think Cooper.
Are we trying to? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think Cooper, that with the cabin, you said Emerson. It's almost as if Gates is mocking. Of somehow escaping it or somehow transcending it, like you're always going to be in the muck.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Totally.
I mean, even they themselves. I mean, isn't there like a historical example of those guys having a commune, the Transcendentalists having a commune, and they almost starved to death because they were unable to efficiently do anything? They just spent their time writing poetry and like looking at plants unfurling.
Yeah, our people always talk about him going over to the Emersons for dinner.
As he was living in the Walden Pond.
Or, like, taking his laundry to his mom, I think.
Yeah. People, oh, never mind. I don't want to start defending Thoreau. Talk about it's another podcast.
That's right.
We're another podcast. Thoreau podcast. Do it.
There are so many things that happen in this book, but because it's passed through so lightly through Jernigan's perspective, that I'm finding it hard to like try to remember, like pinpoint these little situations or things that have happened. Does anybody else feel that way?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I have something.
Yeah,
I can remember.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jordan.
Oh, I was gonna say we haven't talked about Uncle Fred at all.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and acid trips.
And acid trips. Yeah, oh, that was, those were the glory days.
That's right, 23 of them to be exact.
Because there's like a before Uncle Fred and after Uncle Fred. You know, we get to see Uncle Fred with his apartment and his fiance, and he seems content and he seems pretty down to earth and what I would call like a normal person in this Jernigan world.
He has the most enviable life, even as a reader that's just as jaded as Jernigan is. As a reader, that world does not seem bad at all.
Exactly. I think he starts to mock it, but I think also because his Uncle Fred, he sort of is fine with that. And like you said, maybe jealous of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the one thing that he really doesn't openly mock and destroy with his contempt and irony. Is Uncle Fred's relationship.
Hmm. Yeah, Uncle Fred is kind of this...
a double, right?
What do you mean?
A foil?
Yeah, like somebody who...
reflects what...
was on a similar path and then...
Oh, right, exactly.
Seems to have gone a different way.
That's a good way to put it.
He took the other pill.
Right.
He took the red pill, I guess. I don't know.
I can't remember which one's the cool one. And
oh, shit. Fuck. Which one do I take?
Well, I'm not going to tell you again. He took the conformity pill. He seemed to have done a pretty good job at it. His uncle.
Yeah, I mean, is this novel about conformity and nonconformity?
Hmm.
I think it's with satisfaction and not being satisfied.
Yeah. It's kind of like a quality type thing.
Or is it the nonconformity of conformity?
Oh, God.
Trick!
Conformity.
Conforming to nonconformity?
Yeah, sure.
Clarissa. That's Danny's girlfriend's name. Sorry, I'm trying to remember these characters we have.
Well, so that was interesting, too. Yeah. She had an acid trip, and he was talking her down.
He had to take her to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Which was if we're gonna believe Jernigan, who saw that through the prism of that was Danny's friend who killed himself, way of like making sure that she couldn't stop him, because didn't she say that like they went to the mall and he gave it to her and he supposedly took it, but when Jernigan talked to him, he seemed sober.
Right.
And Clarissa is a whole fucking mess unto herself.
Yeah.
I mean, we get the worst possible version of her because it's through Jernigan, who has nothing but contempt for this young teenager. You know, constantly whenever we encounter her, she's staring vacantly at something. She has dead eyes.
That's so great.
She's not understanding what's going on. Like, that's constantly how he describes her. Which is interesting because, again, we don't get any other perspective besides Jernigan's on the other people in the book.
I think something that really stood out to me when I read this was when he took her to the hospital when she was tripping on. I guess it couldn't have been. Was it definitely acid?
I don't know. I'm not sure if we ever get. I think it's described as a pill, right? Like he got a couple of pills.
Color.
Yeah, I'm sure it was playing off that whole party drug scene in like the late '80s. Like, you know, we're taking this. Yeah.
The nurse makes a comment like, "Oh, we've seen this before."
Yeah.
They give her a shot for something.
Yeah, I've never heard of somebody getting a shot for a trip.
I don't know what it is, but
that one drummer kid like knew about it, like when he was talking to Clarissa, is that her name?
Clarissa, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, because she mentions at one point, he said that there's a pill for it if it gets too bad, that I just have to go to the hospital. I need to go to the hospital now. You know, she was very like hanging on to that notion that she had to get to the hospital because he had provided this information to her.
I mean, we get to see that she had a drug problem before, right? It was intravenous drug problem. I don't think it ever specifies heroin or whatnot, but
yeah.
I think it is heroin.
Well, that just goes to like the addiction everywhere in this book, I think. Like,
the lack of supervision too.
But yeah, there's no adults really. Like everybody's
the whole TV, you know, television is the parenting.
Mm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense why Gates like football is.
Right.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
That's David Fox.
That's kind of like the next
for our listeners.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm pretentious. Fuck.
We asshole.
We do get a lot of like TV talk in this book too. There's constant mention of
TV set,
the TV set, and the black and white TV versus the color TV. The putting on and off of the tablecloth when they're done with the TV.
The baseball game.
Him constantly watching again Star Trek and his other television shows that he starts to watch when he gets fired.
The numbing agents. It's almost like go ahead.
But he's also like an active participant in it. I mean, he actively watches Star Trek. It's not like he just zones out. Like he knows what he's doing as far as, oh, I gotta be home at this time to watch this, you know, TV show at this hour. And
well, that just goes to how intricately he, or how carefully he makes sure he has a regimen. Like he talks about, you know, eating the Pamprins and
right.
Delicately managing his consciousness with a whole bunch of gin, but
which he switches the gin for a very alcoholic reason, right?
Is it again?
It doesn't make his breath smell bad, or it's something he specifies gin. He's a very specific man.
He's worried about all the wrong stuff, I think, is probably the larger point.
Yeah.
Like he's really, really worried about the wrong stuff and not worried at all about, you know, his son, for example.
I end up at the end of this book just feeling, I don't know, I felt bad for Danny, but also by the end of the novel, he presents himself to the reader as like a pretty capable person. He's pretty aware of what's going on between him and Clarissa. Mm. He's the one who gets Clarissa's real dad, the violent, abusive one, out of the house.
Mm.
He takes charge, so I'm almost fine with leaving him how he is. I'm not concerned with him, even as having Jernigan as a father.
I have something. I wanted to say earlier about the Clarissa thing, that very, very, not very often throughout the whole book does Gates ever make a reference that kind of shows how Jernigan is, I mean, he's obviously flawed, but like doing things that even Gates thinks that he shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. Sort of like whatever he's doing is right in a sense, just because he's doing it.
Yeah.
Except for the part where he's taking her home after the trip, Clarissa, and there's this sort of, I was trying to find it earlier, but she's looking at the stars and he can't see what she can see. And it does seem like if he could see what she could see and everything would be okay. Mm. It references back his trips, psychedelic trips with Uncle Fred, and like how that was something of the best life he had, and that he needs to sort of remember that, or he needs to return to that somehow. I don't know. It just seemed like one of the few times, just to bring the point home, that there is an alternative. I think. I don't think he should be this big-headed throughout. He can somehow find solace in something.
Well, and that's what the last line is about, right? Do you want to read that last line?
Yeah, I mean, do it, J-Bone.
Did you mean me? Or
Cooper's got it here.
That's fine.
So this last line is he's in the treatment center. It's come full circle. He's actually talking about, you know, addiction at this point. And the last couple lines are, there's other things I won't do. One, see Danny. Two, shave. And three, buy into this pretense that we're all little first name humans here going soul to soul. I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. I'm such-and-such and I'm a drug addict. I'm somebody else and so forth and so on. But when it comes around to you, you have to give them something. If only name and spiritual disease, that's the rule here. So what I figure out is this. I stand up and say, Jernigan. So even at the end, he's not admitting to anything. To anything.
Except that he's Jernigan.
Oh, no, wait. Oh, I was thinking about something different. It's when he talks about his grandpa or something wasting away just smoking cigarettes day in and day out, and how you seem to have a choice. Is that ringing a bell? Like,
I remember the grandfather, but I don't remember the choice part.
I don't really remember the grandfather. Did he figure prominently?
Well, no, not prominently at all, but it was just an image he had of his grandfather wasting away in like a recliner, just watching TV and drinking and smoking, and how basically it was a picture of what he could be and what he will likely be, but how there is some control in making hay with what you're given.
Like he prefers that to his father dying in some alcohol-induced accident or something.
Ah, shit. Yeah, that's I don't have it.
That's like the Achilles versus Odysseus. I don't know if maybe that's not what you're pushing here. But.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was right at the end there, but it's not. So I don't have it. Well, let's start on a different tangent there.
His father, if I remember correctly, like you said, he was drunk and he actually burnt his house down with him inside of it.
It's kind of coyly referenced that. That's what I got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It never actually.
Because he had his, space heater? Or no, he had a wood stove in his studio. Yeah. Which was like a converted old chicken coop. And so. He was probably a drunk. Oh, but then again, his rule was he didn't take any sauce, as he called it, into the workshop.
Ah, but I think he broke his rule. I think he didn't have integrity.
That's right. And that led to his death and burning down the estate.
Yeah. Yeah. The ruins.
Yeah, that's right. Like that was a nice description of like coming to see it. And it was just like the brick foundations still there.
Yeah. Yeah. When they go to cut down their Christmas tree,
that was a good scene. Mm-hmm. It was strange.
That was probably the best camaraderie between him and his son. And it wasn't a classical sense of camaraderie.
No,
was there.
I read a weird sort of Jernigan like came off as, I guess, is like the weaker one, which I guess we already kind of knew, but you really saw the dynamic between him and Danny, where Danny just was on his own path and had already made the choice to not really give Jernigan the time of day or respect. Which is maybe like Martha and his first wife's problem, is they kept giving in to his bullshit.
Mm.
Which drove them both just fucking bonkers.
Well, it's pretty impossible to be a woman and go against him in this world. In this novel and in real life. But
he just has this way of just getting a hold of these women, except for, of course, the was it secretary he tries to get with when he gets fired, and she just won't have anything to do with him?
Denied.
Poor guy.
I'm just happy.
Oh, I mean, Jernigan. Bad man. He's a bad man.
Did you guys ever think that he was going to try and sleep with Clarissa?
Yes, I totally had that vibe.
Yeah, what does that say about him? Because I definitely thought so too. At a certain point, he was gonna fuck up and accidentally fuck her. I mean, he saw her tits, and throughout the rest of the book, he did keep thinking about them.
Right, and I just thought, I was wondering how far Gates had taken it, and so that's just where my mind is. Like, naturally, my mind personally went to like the maximum level.
Yeah,
I'm just a sick fuck, so it's fine.
But again, his descriptions of her is so inhuman. You know, he makes her most unappealing, just sad non-human of the book.
Full status.
Essentially, yeah. Which, you know, Danny does reference that, you know, she has her own problems that Danny's more aware of and sympathetic to than. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes out that her father did something to her sexually, Jernigan could really care less. He knew it. Yeah. He didn't let that shit. Like, he didn't think back on his view of Clarissa and let it change that. He just was like, okay, that's a fact.
Right.
I think, like, as far as talking about him as a maybe, if you could call him a hero, like the most anti-hero of anti-heroes, but
right,
he has this kind of brutal honesty where he has these feelings that are so true. It's almost like, I know, I kind of feel the same way. Like, I kind of don't care about my parents that much. Like, shit that you don't would never actually say.
Right.
sense with himself that he says it, and it kind of makes you think, like, well, I kind of feel the same way too. Like, even to the point where, like, yeah, his son's kind of annoying and, like, shitty. Like, I guess I love him, but, like, you never hear anyone say that. Like, either they're like, totally evil and you don't care about them, and these are characters that you are not supposed to sympathize with.
Yeah.
Or they do care about their children, or, you know, they're, like, they have fights with their wife, but they still love them.
Right.
But he's, like, such, like, I've never seen a character that was, it's so sympathetic, yet so, just
evil.
But I don't even know if it's evil, because it's honest. Because he didn't want to sleep with his daughter, his stepdaughter.
Right.
I don't know if, I don't know if evil's the word, but.
What sticks out when he said that, and actually, it's, like, the one thing that's kind of stuck out to me after reading this book, is that part where, again, I can't remember the specifics, but it's maybe Danny talking about going out and driving with his friends. And Jernigan sort of plays it off, and then in his own mind says, oh, that's just wishing your own son dead. Like, what I just did was like, oh, you can go drink and drive, I don't care. And then his thought was like, I just wish my own son dead.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Mm. Just like, yeah. Brutal, brutal honesty.
And like you said, like, that's a great way of putting it. So I think I felt the same way, where, like, I wasn't revolted by that thought. And I think I identified with it. Mm. Like you said, like, there are times where I'm like, I'm not close with my parents, and I don't like them, or any of those thoughts that you wish you didn't have, but you have to, at some point in your life, admit to some of them.
Well, yeah. If our parents are listening, we're really, really, really sorry.
they're Philistines.
Well, and I think part of what makes him sympathetic is, like, if you look at the circumstances, like, he has been sort of surrounded by tragedy, and it is hard to say how much of that you can blame him for, and how much of, like, his continued disgusting behavior you can blame him for.
Which is so anti-American. Like, that's so anti-Horatio Alger story.
Mm.
You know, like, we're supposed to be able to rise above our beginnings or the circumstances of our life. And like you said, he's kind of made the choice to just accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this shit's happened to me, and I'm just going to go with it.
Well, and so I found that excerpt that I want to read, because I think this is sort of the heart of the thing. So he's talking about being in the rehab facility. He says, well, it's on page 228. It's the very beginning of section 3 in whatever part of the book here. It says, being in this place among all these drunks, hearing their family stories, always the same family history pretty much, it just makes you think, no escape for old Danny. I mean, not just me and Judith, but going way the hell back. My father, Judith's father, who died the year before I met her. Parentheses, 62 years old, heart attack, heavy smoker, heavy drinker. Unparentheses. Judith's grandfather, for Christ's sake. Her father's father. I forget anymore what the story was with her mother's father. And then he goes to his own grandfather. I saw the grandfather once. We were on the way to Boston for Rick's graduation, which the family had agreed just not to tell Gramp about, and stopped off at his bungalow in Westerly. An empty Four Roses bottle lay among the empty broadcast corned beef hash cans in the grocery bag he used for garbage. Another Four Roses bottle, half full, stood beside his recliner chair. He just sat there, not reclining, a tartan blanket over his knees. Unshaven, cheekbones sticking out to here, false teeth in a peanut butter jar on the end of the table. Rather, on the end table. Watching a Western on snowy black and white TV. Said he was sorry the place stunk so bad. The government was putting something in the water to make him piss his pants. Another mirror of Jernigan's own pissing of pants. This is not a moral failing, I told myself, but an affliction. To keep transmitting such an affliction, though, was that not a moral failing? I used to wonder, I still wonder, Danny or no Danny, if Judith ought not to have had an abortion and just let the goddamn thing end right there.
End scene.
Yeah, so he's, I'm not sure how much I have to say about that. It kind of speaks for itself, but he is trying to find, like, what Jordan was talking about before with an alternative, you know, like.
Right.
We do have maybe some choice about continuing on destructive patterns in our family history or, you know, like, and part of it is where the nihilism plays in, you know, like wondering if she should have just had an abortion and not even have Danny in the world.
Right.
Like that's one quasi solution, is just not to deal with the thing at all. And it seems to be like the one that he'd be most likely to do. But
maybe that's his apathy showing.
Yeah.
He's like so apathetic. He won't even bring himself to try to persuade her for an abortion.
Right. Maybe. I mean, I guess that's a different angle.
Did who? What was the story with the abortion? Did they just agree on it? Or sorry, what am I saying? Forget it.
No, he's wondering. No. He's talking about like these lineages on both sides for Danny, where both his father, Jernigan, had alcoholism and other sorts of problems in the family, and the mother also had alcoholism in the family. Mm-hmm. He's sort of hopeless.
The alcoholism killed his father almost directly.
Right.
Of fire. And being asleep, and the fire contributing to the alcohol contributing to the fire.
Right.
It Danny just smokes, right? He never really drinks.
Yeah, we don't really see him drink.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for all you know, he just smokes pot. Plays his guitar religiously. Which, much to the chagrin of Jernigan, who seems to be like, I mean, at some points he comes off as being like a father, you know, sort of talking about, I'm not quite sure what this will lead for you.
Mm.
You're not naturally talented, so I don't know why you're putting so much time and effort into doing this thing. But other times he just seems that it just upsets him for the mere fact that he does it, and whatever Danny does is going to upset him.
Mm. You think that's some kind of effect from his father being an artist and a creative type, and seeing his own father struggle, and he doesn't want Danny to be part of that, maybe some subconscious type of thing.
But his father didn't struggle for all we know. I mean, he made a bunch of money.
Amassed an estate.
Right.
I mean, he didn't have anybody his own death. But
I mean, as far as like struggle maybe mentally from being someone who's an artist or whatever, something that to that effect is, I wonder if that had some kind of effect on his idea of Danny as being a musician.
I think just anything that anybody does is going to upset Jernigan.
That's kind of what I was – or if you want to get more personal with it, like Jernigan obviously has creative interests. You know, he does some like music criticism in there, references to Webb Pierce, which is pretty cool. So I wonder if like his skepticism towards Danny's musical pursuit is related to his own failure to pursue – his anything own interests or anything, yeah.
right, totally.
Because he went to school for literature, right? Or he just studied it because it was around the house. At one point, I think he makes comment too. Do we know what he did for schooling and or whatnot?
Was he an architect?
No, he seems artier. I'm pretty sure it was something like English.
Just like an English like degree.
Yeah, I'm always surprised like how dumb he sounds sometimes, and then he just sounds so smart, and it's believable.
Right.
What's the dumb guy part?
Sometimes, well, just like how he can literally just like sit in front of a TV for so long. Like, I feel like he's such a brilliant man that even at that point, I feel like he'd be above that, but he's not. That's important.
I think there's a part where he's
for sure
about to have sex with Martha. But he's worrying about getting done in time so he can catch Star Trek on TV. Yeah. There's that whole, like, he wants everything. He wants sex and entertainment and, you know, substance and...
Well, yeah, you just sort of a black hole that way, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
My thing is, the more I think about it, the less likely I am to call him a genius or brilliant or intelligent. Because I think those things have to denote a certain amount of... You have to do something about it. A man squandering whatever talents he has, I don't call that brilliant or intelligent.
But a lot of our favorite artists spend a lot of time wasting away.
But, I mean, Jernigan's not an artist. He's nothing. He's literally, like, a no man.
Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about specific pursuits?
He's like a Dan man. Huh?
Like, he got, I mean, for 15 years at that company, he had to have got a job, like, right after college if he went to college.
But he makes, like, these arty references all the time. Like, they're funny and they're sharp and...
Right.
I mean, at one point, he says he makes a Beckett reference when he's trying to get into his Uncle Fred's house, and I can't go on. I will go on.
Oh, Walt
Stevens as well.
Yeah, Walt Stevens. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's read. You know, he's well read, and again, he mentions that when somebody in the book questions that, he says, yeah, there was a lot of books lying around my house when I was growing up. You know, before his mother left his father, it seems like they were a pretty smart family.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm reluctant to call him brilliant just because, again, he just hasn't done anything.
I think there's potential, I guess, is maybe a better way. Like, he could have been a very brilliant person, especially with his father. I don't know. Just like a lot of his tendencies seem like he could have been someone. If he's this interested, if he can endure this long.
Yeah.
I think
maybe his brilliance lies in just his ability to critically think about things in general, and maybe not his application of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only sometimes is he critical, though. I mean, only sometimes does he allow the outside world to filter in and, like, take a stance on it. Otherwise, he's just being ironic and sarcastic.
Mm. Which is his own form of criticism, too, though.
Right. That's what I was thinking, is that his form of critical thinking is his, like, sarcastic and kind of... absurd view of the world.
Right.
One of the important pillars of genius, I think I was talking to Phil about this, but not saying that there is a distinct one, but I remember hearing somebody talk about the pillars of genius, and one of them being passion. And if you don't have passion, you don't have genius. And I think that perfectly describes Jernigan. He's a very passionate man.
Almost. But there are things that he is passionate about, like Webb Pierce or whatever.
That was actually Martha who liked Webb Pierce.
No, but he talks about how she has such good taste for putting that on.
Okay.
Right.
So, like, and so there's stuff that's dormant for him, I think, that he could activate, like passion.
Right.
So you know, like, and that relates to how sensitive he is.
Yeah. Hey, well, yeah. Sorry.
I just found him very not likable.
I didn't like him.
It's the big jerk. I like jerk again.
He's a lot of people call him the grown-up Holden Caulfield. You know, Holden Caulfield as an adult was a pretty common critical comment on his character.
Definitely.
How do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, he definitely took some from – David Gates is definitely pulling a lot of inspiration from maybe not just Catcher in the Rye, but a lot of J.D. Salinger style paranoia and writing comes through in this book.
I agree.
Yeah, I think if he grew up and he read Beckett, this is what it'd sound like. Which I think is funny because Beckett really liked Catcher in the Rye when it came out.
Really?
That's not surprising because it has kind of a pedestrian use of language.
Yeah.
Which I guess so does Beckett sometimes.
but the difference is, I mean, maybe if we're saying that Jernigan is potentially the grown-up version of Holden Caulfield, again, this is not some sort of fan fiction, this is just comparing two literary characters, but Holden Caulfield, his problems lie that he cares so much, you know, particularly about children. He cares so much about the youth of America. You know, he cares a lot, and I could not say that about Jernigan at all.
Not at all?
I don't think he cares one iota about anything.
I think that age difference is very significant, though. I think, like, you saw that he was much more inspired, Jernigan, I mean, as a young person tripping in his 20s.
Right.
And I don't know. And I can see Holden Caulfield like, oh, I can't save anyone. And when you can't save anyone, then what?
Right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
So, maybe. I mean, I'm not going to negate that, but I don't know.
Because I still hold that this whole book is just not necessarily like a mental breakdown, but, I mean, he's still clearly suffering from the loss of his wife. Who I still contend there is real love for. The one scene we get to see it, I think that,
And she is drugged up, and he mentions that because she just gave birth to their son. But I think there was real love there, and I think he's – I mean, that's tragic. I don't care who you are.
So that's something that he cares about.
Yeah. That's an argument to make. Mm-hmm. Just taking stuff from the novel, if you just took the novel at face value, that would be hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think applying, like, real actual human psychology to it, mm-hmm. I think this whole, again, and a lot of critics have saying this is, you know, the story of one man going off the edge and being totally fine with it. But I think it's because of the loss of his wife that led him to even approaching that edge to begin with.
It seems that's a good segue into what this book says about patriarchy, maybe. Like how women are depicted in this book when they are.
Yeah, totally. Like Martha is kind of the home provider, and she does it through sort of natural means.
Right. Like I was thinking today, like if you looked at my house and you're like, hey, this is a decent house. Like, good job, Phil.
Uh-huh.
Like, yeah. It's not me doing any of that work, really. Like,
I've never once thought that you contributed.
No, but that just goes to a larger point. I think that, like, when you look around, like, women are really the ones who are running the world. I heard, like, a stat the other day in a lecture that said that, like, women are responsible for 90% of the labor that gets done in the world. They're also the least paid.
Say who manages all, though.
Well, right. Bloated ass Jernigans.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I mean, he doesn't represent the patriarchy. I mean, he's
really. Isn't he like the picture of the patriarchy?
He willingly like doesn't work. He moves into the mother of his son's girlfriend's house. Mm. Sells his house because why would they keep it? Just lays around, watches TV, and drinks. But I would say if he went around taking credit for that, he would be an example of patriarchy. But he couldn't even care enough to do that.
Mm.
He's perfectly fine just letting her do whatever. I mean, then again, it's Jernigan, so he doesn't really care about anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think he represents a lot of the patriarchy. I mean, I guess technically everyone.
I mean, he's a white male with decent means. Like,
yeah. Expects her to mother him a lot too, and like kind of like figure things out or make things right for him. If you take a psychoanalytic approach and see her as the mom that's supposed to basically, she's supposed to feed from her teat and like be like told.
Briefly addresses racial issues too, not really in depth, but there's that part where he meets that redheaded woman on the street when he's taking a walk.
Oh yeah, that was funny.
He asks if the neighborhood's all right, and she's like, if you mean that the blacks are moving in, then no, you know, we haven't had a problem with that or something like that. And he was just like, okay, well, yeah, anyways.
Yeah. Right. He has enough in him to like be made upset by that comment. He doesn't agree with that woman's sentiment.
Yeah. Cause internally he kind of was like, you know, why would I care? The darkness, he said something to the effect that darkness and, you know, of her, it took 2 minutes for the darkness in her to like show itself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's why I don't think he's something that you would call evil, Jernigan.
Mm.
I think like David Gates makes a point in these situations to show like he's just a really lazy motherfucker,
right?
Or just like a really like damaged guy, mm-hmm. but he's not someone that's like malicious. He's not malicious for the sake of being malicious. He's malicious for the sake of his own insecurity.
So are we supposed to take him and expound that he is like an example or symbolic of a part of American culture? Or is this just a story about a guy named Jernigan, and we are just made aware of his life?
Both.
Both, for sure.
I think more of the latter, but...
I think so, too. I don't know if this really is symbolic or representative of anything more than what David Gates is just trying to tell this man's story, and we're just along for the ride.
He's the rebel. I mean, people don't live like this.
Exactly. Like, this doesn't happen. This isn't a thing.
No.
This man shoots himself. This man, like, he witnesses, he finds his friend's friend who killed himself. Like, I don't think this is supposed to be every man. I don't think this is supposed to be representative of even like American culture at the time. He just briefly, you know, he places it in a historical time frame by mentioning TV sets and television shows and music and whatnot.
Walkmans.
But I don't think this is supposed to be taken and made to draw comparisons to the rest of American society in the late 1980s.
Isn't that what books are for, though?
But maybe it's more of a cautionary tale. Be wary of Peter Jernigan's story.
Well, you guys know him, and you made mention in the beginning of this that this is a lot like, I mean, you could definitely read David Gates in Jernigan's character.
I feel like this is how he thinks about life and the internal dialogue in this. He's just going through thinking like this all the time. And this was like kind of almost a stream of consciousness sometimes in the, and that's just my personal opinion from watching the way he talks about stories and like workshop and stuff. It's very kind of stream of consciousness type criticism where he's kind of sitting there thinking, talking, not really asking for anybody to respond to his thoughts, but kind of just go, like mulling through it out loud.
Right. And like, and to answer Phil's question, no, I don't think every book has to be some sort of slice of life into a culture or a personality type. I mean, Holden Caulfield's Catch from the Rye, I don't think is indicative. I don't think it really represents any other part of society. I think that is just a book about the character Holden Caulfield's brief mental breakdown.
Well, I think he's also like kind of the mirror. He's holding up the mirror to the society and like showing like what this looks like.
I guess
from an outside perspective.
That's my point, is that like, well, when you say he's not every man, like, isn't it your job as a fiction writer to create a character that to some extent feels like every man? Like that lots of people can relate to?
Well, I guess that's
maybe.
That's potential for fiction. I mean, some of the greatest novels are the exact opposite of that. We're meant to relate to the
character. Yeah, what about Harry Potter? He's not the everyman.
I was thinking of more like Lolita, where it's he's not at all the everyman, but he is made relatable. Is that what you're getting at?
Weren't we just talking about earlier how Jernigan is relatable?
When you say everyman, I thought you just mean like, does he represent what people were like in the 80s, like your average consumer American person, which he's not that.
Are we going to have to add definitions to this show now so we can understand each other?
It'll be in the appendix at the end of this.
The it's notes
evolving as we do it.
Yes. He's relatable.
So he's not every man, but he does have a job like most people, you know, like.
Yeah.
He's got to fit he has to operate in the same system that everybody else does.
Right.
And I think part of what is like powerful about him is that he is such a sensitive and critical guy, you know, towards himself and towards his surroundings, that he exposes lots of stuff that most people don't see.
And what about
when he starts talking about it, you can start clicking with it.
Definitely.
And I feel like he, a lot of the everyman maybe comes out in his child rearing, because he's often saying things to Danny, like being kind of stern parent about stuff, like almost overly stern compared to what he does himself with like pot and sex. Like he almost, like he kind of wants to chastise Danny, even though, you know, he's doing the same type of stuff as Danny.
Because I think that's just like this.
Yeah.
His character is, he's aware of what he needs to do. And again, he does make these mental comments to himself like, oh, I feel like I should say something to Danny about this behavior. Like he's aware of what he should do. And then he either makes light of it, makes a mockery of it, or actually, you know, there's instances where he actually does do it as well.
Right.
I should chastise Danny, and he does it. And in typical Jernigan fashion, it's not how I would do it or what I mean, think.
Sometimes he often regrets it afterwards too, I felt.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
It's very human.
Very human.
So he's the everyman, we decided.
No, I would not say
I guess that. We could I'll look it up on Urban Dictionary if you guys wanted.
That's okay.
Yeah. Thank you though, Eric.
Because he feels very removed. Like I was saying earlier, like a lot of the things he did made me uncomfortable reading it, because they're things that I would have never chosen to have done.
Uh-huh.
So I would say no, I don't think it represents the everyman. Whatever the fuck that even is supposed to mean. Are you looking that up on Urban Dictionary?
he's like, you guys ever see Taxi Driver?
Yeah, with Robert De Niro.
Yeah, he's like Bickle. He's like Thomas Bickle.
Right. I mean, because, and then, he is the. I hate to use the word outcast. I don't know why I'm so reluctant.
Yeah.
Want to say outcast, but he is.
He definitely is. Yeah. He's just the guy that's like, here's a man who stood up. He's like one of those. He's only standing up and shouting.
Yeah.
In like the form of this novel, really, or this memoir, or whatever you want to call it.
Right. It was interesting too. In Taxi Driver, I would say, is it Bickle? Is that the character?
Yeah, Bickle. Yeah.
He doesn't make the choice. I mean, there's clearly something mentally off with that character in Taxi Driver that forces him to be an outcast. Whereas, I mean, we've all spent this entire time talking about how Jernigan is a very smart, sensitive man. And I don't think there's any mental failing in him that forces him to be on the outside looking in.
Like, he's not mentally unstable?
No, I don't think so. Because Bickle in the movie is constantly trying to make choices that would normalize him. And he's failing. You know, he takes that woman on a date and takes her to a porno theater because he thinks that's a normal thing to do.
Yeah, I like that. Okay.
Jernigan's purposely making choices that an insane person or something to that effect would do because he wants to be free of his sanity or something.
Like maybe he's like a wannabe outcast.
Right, yeah, exactly. And he sees these like suburban survivalists living rough, eating rabbit stew.
I want to sit him down and ask him, like, all right, Jernigan, I just read your fucking little AA memoir, but what would make you happy then? Tell me, like, what life do you see that you wouldn't bitch about so much?
You'd say, I hear there's a game on. That sounds pretty heavenly.
So Star Trek's going to be on in a couple minutes.
Star Trek's going to be on soon.
Jordan, you mentioned earlier about how blurry the presentation was with this memoir.
Wait, what do you mean?
Like how much he jumps around.
Oh, I guess, yeah, I suppose that it's not like this clear, like, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. It's much more fluid and seamless. Kind of like, I don't want to say, not mirage, but it's very normal. It feels like a very, like, banal in the sense that it just kind of, like, goes to these little scenes. And I mean, I like how I was very afraid at the very end some really dramatic thing was going to happen where, like, and then he shot his wife or something like that, or then, like, there'd be some, like, major altercation. And thankfully, I was still intrigued without resorting to some kind of old something you'd see like in a 19th century novel or just any novel that's not like that's popular.
Because it's like the most normal ending we could ever have imagined. We see that he has a problem and he goes to AA to fix that problem. Like,
but he's not really there to fix it.
No, I mean, that's the whole point of the end of the book is that he's like letting himself a little wink like, but you'll never fix me. Mm-hmm. But it's also like Jordan's pointing out, like, it's not surprising. Like, if you just told the story to somebody, like, there's this book about this alcoholic. Oh, how's the book end? Oh, he goes to rehab. Mm-hmm.
Which I think also shows that there's never the event. It just is kind of the series of just mediocrity. Mm. There's not really like this catharsis where like, oh, and then like I shot my wife and then I realized how evil I was or how fucked up I was. It's just sort of like, he's just like always staving it off and always just keeping it at arm's length.
It's almost like him waiting for the next big thing after that, the big thing with his wife that happened too. Because he imagines that Martha's cheating on him, other stuff with Danny, like Danny killing himself, you know.
Yeah, that romanticizes his condition. Yeah. It never comes. Maybe it will come, but maybe it'll be too late.
Right.
Right. Because he would never say that he had a rock bottom, like using like the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think he would admit that he ever had a rock bottom.
No, but that the beginning, I think, would probably be the rock bottom.
Right. We as a viewer could point out many instances where we'd be like, yeah, but what about this? What about this?
Yeah.
The fucking scumbag.
Well, that's what's kind of cool about him, though, too, I think, is like So on the one hand, he's got this leveling intelligence that sort of places everything on the same plane, and that takes away his ability to really weigh things properly. Mm-hmm. But what's cool about that is like he can kind of take little moments and see humor or beauty in them.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not paying attention to the like huge ass things that are going down.
Obvious right. problems.
The right. obvious right. problem. Yeah, right.
Yeah, just ignoring the obvious.
Right. Like his job or his financial status.
Right.
He just ignored his job that one day and got fired.
Right.
The death of his wife, seeing his son's friend kill himself, or not, seeing the aftermath of it. And
Just a quick commentary. I have to probably be gone. I have to sub in the morning and get up in like 6 hours.
Yeah, it's getting late. I think we've probably put a good stretch on this podcast.
Yeah. Maybe we could end with what do you guys think? Like, is it a dumb question to say, did you like it overall? Like, would you recommend it?
No. I don't think it's dumb. I think we should all each give like ending thoughts about it. And
Okay. So let's just go around the horn here. Seems like we've touched on most of the stuff we wanted to. Jordan, do you want to start with closing thoughts? What you thought of the book, if you'd recommend it?
Yeah, I think what really struck me the most was his integrity. I think the fact that he was a figure that was able to stand up to everyone. And I think his honesty, and like I said, his ability to truths about how he feels about other people made me really less alone. And that sounds so cheesy. Like, here I am. But it made me understand, like, oh, no, those aren't like psychological disturbances. That's just people being people and people that are honest. And if you don't admit that to yourself, like Jernigan does, I think you're a lesser person. So I think that's something really cool about Jernigan. I really, really enjoyed it. I'm really glad I got nominated for the Pulitzer. I thought they would not take something this dark, but they did.
Yeah, it was a finalist for the Pulitzer, and I think one other major fiction award. It was another finalist for, like, the Penn Choice Awards like or something.
Faulkner?
No, it wasn't Faulkner. But it was another one.
All right, Eric, can just move on to Eric.
Eric, what do you think?
So my thoughts are I personally really liked it and enjoyed the character and enjoyed his writing style, too. I thought it was kind of unique. And I like the little like inner monologue stuff where he's talking to himself and it's kind of interweaving actual dialogue between that and what he's actually saying. So I would say it's definitely kind of more of a slower methodical read, I think. It's nothing super, you know, action packed or anything, but I think the character is interesting enough for me to worth a read just to kind of, you know, get in this weird, absurd world.
Phil?
Yeah, I like the book. I'm the one that suggested it. I think it's pretty pertinent to modern problems about trying to derive value in a world that seems bent on crushing any attempt at that. It's funny and dark. I think probably, yeah, one of my favorite things about it is like just how darkly funny and smart Jernigan is. Like, there's some really cutting criticisms in here, I think, of culture, you know, particularly like American post-industrial capitalism. But that might just be me.
No. Social malaise.
So for everybody who doesn't know, Phil hates capitalist pigs.
Yeah, I just thought like it was a great portrait of a beautiful soul getting crushed. So I'd recommend it on those bases.
Yeah, slightly. I think that's a good way to put it. He is kind of a beautiful soul.
I really enjoyed reading it. It was one of those books for me that from page one, it grabbed me. As cliche as that sound, and it's a short book. I don't think we mentioned that. I think it's just shy of 300 pages, so it's not
like 230.
Yeah, it's not a big book at all.
237? 238.
I thought it was also very funny and very dark. I enjoyed it for that, those sentiments. I think it was an interesting read in this one man's life, or you know, the 6 months or so that we got to see of his downward spiral, or whatever you want to put it. I'd recommend it to people. It's a small enough book and a quick read, and it's not too complicated. But I would recommend it. Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
All right, guys.
All right, peace out, Waste Fam.
Well, thanks for tuning in, guys. This has been the first episode of Waste Division Book Club. We're calling it Waste Books for now. Check out our website, waste-division.org, for more stuff like this. We've got fiction, critical essays, some comics, and some music. Speaking of music, this music here is a band that Jordan and I started called Bull Market. I'm now playing with a guy named Nels Jensen because Jordan moved to New York City with Idaho Green. Anyway, if you like the music, check it out at waste-division.org. Our reading for next time is Sabbath's Theater by Philip Roth. Pick that up at your independent bookstore or Amazon or whatever, and come talk with us. All right.